And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste, and I'll be your host for today's program. Following National Native News, we'll continue our summer fun series with a profile of Alaska Wedding Adventures with Mary Ann Ray. Allison Gillum and Emma Davis from the Southeast Alaska Land Trust will be here to highlight an upcoming plein air workshop. We're going to find out about ways that Capital Transit is using new technology. And Becca Souza will be here to discuss STEM summer camps. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more, up next on a Juno Afternoon on KTOO News and online via KTOO.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. New Mexico U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich unveiled legislation Tuesday in Albuquerque, which is intended to protect sacred Native American items. Governor of Acoma Pueblo, Kurt Riley, is among tribal leaders backing the senator's bill.
The strength of the Pueblos, or any tribe across this country, depends on the strength of its culture, its ceremonies, and its continued belief in what is most sacred. That strength also comes when we stand together to protect the lifeblood and vitality of our culture.
The New Mexico tribe is working to stop the sale of items showing up in French auctions, which recently included an Acoma shield. Riley says the fight in France is difficult, which is prompting leaders to look to legislation, such as Heinrich's, for help in their fight to regain sacred items.
Today, the effort to protect our culture is just as important as the Pueblo Revolt of 1680. Back then, it was a battle to protect the very essence of who we were as Pueblo people. Back then, the battle was very different. Today, the world is a lot more complicated, more complex, and requires a new strategic approach. Today, we've adopted and used written laws to protect our culture and ourselves.
The Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony, or STOP Act, would increase penalties for violating federal law for stealing or removing tribal objects from 5 years prison time to 10. It would also establish a 2-year amnesty period for people who voluntarily return items to tribes. The bill seeks to prohibit the export of cultural and historical Native American items. Heinrich says he cannot imagine the position tribal leaders are being put in.
And I've heard this articulated by tribal leader after tribal leader. Do we just shell out the money that should be going to education, to infrastructure in places that truly need it, or use what time we have among our limited resources to try to legally fight for these things that rightfully belong to them in the first place? That's just a no-win situation, and we need to change that dynamic.
Heinrich and some tribal leaders are discussing the legislation today in Washington, D.C. Tribes in Alaska can move forward with petitioning the federal government to take lands into trust. A federal appeals court last week dismissed the state of Alaska's challenge in trust litigation. From Anchorage, Lori Townsend has more.
The case seeking the right to apply for trust status was filed against the Interior Department by 4 tribes and 1 individual in 2007. Native American Rights Fund attorney Heather Kendall Miller represented the tribes.
This is huge for tribes in Alaska, and it really opens the door for a new relationship with the state, should the state decide to stop fighting tribes on this issue and work with tribes. It could create all kinds of potential partnerships.
After the Interior Department dropped the lawsuit against Alaska tribes seeking trust status, the state continued its challenge in the case. Kendall Miller says Indian country in Alaska would afford the same protections as reservation land in the lower 48.
3 of the 4 wanted to be able to enhance their regulatory jurisdiction to keep alcohol out and to be able to invoke the Indian liquor laws that would require the federal prosecutor's office to prosecute bootleggers and others that have been bringing alcohol into the community and drugs in the community.
Kendall Miller says now that the stay against Alaska tribal petitions has been lifted, the BIA should publish notice of those trust land applications within 30 days.
I would assume that the tribes that have submitted those petitions will be in contact with the Interior and trying to urge it to move their process along as quickly as possible.
It's not clear if the state will drop its challenge, attempt to continue, or mount a separate lawsuit when petitions are made public. State of Alaska Law Department spokesperson Corey Mills, by email, said the state will determine next steps after a thorough evaluation. I'm Lori Townsend in Anchorage.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio Mary Ann Ray, who is the owner at Pearson's Pond. Welcome to KTOO.
Thank you.
Nice to have you back in the building, in the studios. You're a former volunteer?
Volunteer. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about, it's been a while, so next time around I'm going to volunteer again.
Excellent.
It's always a good time. I enjoy doing it. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome. So, like I said, owner of Pearson's Pond. And real quickly, just I know what that is, but for people who maybe don't know what Pearson's Pond is, why don't you tell folks?
Well, Pearson's Pond is a beautiful bed and breakfast out in the Mendenhall Valley. It's actually the only AAA Four Diamond accommodations in the entire state. We offer a lot in the way of amenities, and it's a very private, secluded kind of a spot, but still very beautiful and serene and close to everything, so it's a big draw for people who are looking to be a little bit outside of the madness that downtown can be when the cruise ships are in, and still enjoy the beauty that is Juneau.
And we've invited you in because you folks offer something, which this is fitting into Jeff Brown's Summer Fun series here on a Juneau afternoon, Alaska Wedding Adventures. So why don't we just start with, tell people what is, if people look at your website and see what's this Alaska Wedding Adventures, what are they going to learn about?
They are going to learn about the different places that are available, the lovely venues that are available to people who are wanting a destination wedding. Everybody who lives here knows how beautiful Juneau is and all those nice little secluded spots where you can have a quiet wedding and still have the glacier in the background or be in the wilderness or be out on a whale watch or up on the glacier. So we offer all of that. We're very interested in having our couples have the type of wedding experience that they want. Some of them are into the big adventure, let's do it on the glacier, let's go on a dog sled and do it out there, and others want a much quieter, more private and out-of-the-way kind of a ceremony. So we're all about the couple's experience. We spend time at the beginning finding out what they're looking for, what they're hoping to have it be. Some of our wedding couples come up on a cruise ship and they just have that one day to get married. And when they want to do a glacier wedding, we hope that we're going to have good weather that day. And surprisingly, we've been really lucky. Rarely do we have to cancel. Have we had to cancel for bad weather on those single day in town wedding experiences. But when they're here for a longer period of time, I'm always a little bit more comfortable waiting to see because we can always reschedule. But the Whale Watch venue is a great venue. You'd be surprised at how many people want to do that. And we've just had couples from all walks of life, mostly from the U.S., that are coming up to stay for an entire wedding moon, or like I say, on the cruise ships. They just want to get away. They don't want to have the big wedding and the stress of a big wedding at home with all their friends and family. They're looking for something smaller and more intimate, and that's what we offer.
So the majority of the people who do this, are they from somewhere else? Are they from somewhere in the lower 48 or internationally? Or do you get a lot of locals who say, I'm from here, but I'm still going to do something different. I'm not going to just do the traditional wedding.
We get local people more often in the wintertime, mm-hmm. who really are just wanting a very quiet and not a fancy kind of a ceremony. But Pearson's Pond is a little small, so where we do smaller local weddings, but we find that most local couples have friends and family and they'd like them to attend, and we might not be the best venue for that. So it's when we aren't, we refer them to somebody who can help them. We always want to do what's right for them. So if it's not going to be the best experience, we'll help them find somebody who will give them the best experience.
So the phrase or the title, Adventure Wedding, I'm assuming that's kind of a new thing. Is that a relatively new thing? I mean, I don't remember 20, 30 years ago hearing about adventure weddings. Maybe they were happening and I was just living a boring life. But
well, I think that people now, we get the younger couples who want to go and have an adventure while they're getting married. So they're looking to go to Alaska, Wild Alaska, spend some time here, see what's going on, have an exciting kind of wedding. Oftentimes those are our glacier weddings. They'll want to do the thing on the glacier and tie in a dog sled, for example. That's a big one. So we'll have that. And then we'll have sometimes older couples who this might be their second time around, and they want to have something that's a little calmer, but Alaska's on their bucket list, so they want to do it up here. And they're always really surprised at how beautiful it is and how it meets what they were looking for. So, and that's what we try to do, is to provide what the guest wants, what the couple is looking for.
Mm-hmm. So you touched on the, I think you've mentioned the glacier a couple of times.
Yeah.
Now. You've mentioned whale watching. So do you have like a set package of the kinds of things that you would offer?
We do. We have packages for glacier weddings, for a wilderness weddings, for a whale watch wedding. We will design, and some people want something entirely different.
Right.
They'll want to take
customize
a boat out to one of the small cabins, and we'll work that out with them. So we do that as well. A lot of people don't know exactly what the breadth of possibilities are, so we'll kind of go through that with them. And then some have some very definite ideas. I was mentioning to Jeff a little earlier how we had one couple who were going to get married on a glacier no matter what. They were not going to be traditional, didn't wear the white dress or the tuxedo. They wore their blue jeans, their hiking boots, and after the ceremony they ripped off their shirts and they opened a bottle of Alaskan ale. That was how they celebrated their wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So that's their version of adventure.
Yeah. So how far in advance do people need to plan for this? I mean, I'm assuming people can't call you up a month out and say, here's what we want to do. Or how flexible are you?
No, they can. They can call me whenever. We're actually already starting to work on a lot of weddings for next year. So we've got about six that have already started to plan. And we have one that started planning that a year ago. So some people plan very far in advance. We have gotten calls from people who are on a cruise ship, stopped in Ketchikan, that want to get married in Juneau in 2 days, you know. So we get, it's...
And you'll make it happen.
We'll make it happen. We'll make it happen. It's always fun, too. There's never a dull moment.
And I, excuse me if I wasn't listening closely enough earlier. Are there other people in town who also offer this kind of service?
Yes, Alaska Weddings on Ice mm-hmm. offers this kind of service. For the bigger... more complicated weddings. Creativations is big. Glacier Gardens does weddings, the top of Mount Roberts Tram, they do weddings. And there are quite a few marriage commissioners in town who don't necessarily advertise and don't necessarily get, they would get a call from me to help them do the wedding rather than a call from a couple. Although sometimes they do that too.
And is it your sense it's a growing, I mean, there are more and more people each year? Do you feel like there's more people choosing this kind of adventure and or destination for their weddings?
I think that it has to do with a lot with advertising, because I think a lot of people, when they think a destination wedding for themselves, they're thinking of something in the Caribbean, you know, something on a beach. But then if they get hit with that Alaska advertising, then that sometimes will change their mind. And also, some people are a little bit worried about the Zika virus. So we've had couples who have decided to come up here instead of going to the Caribbean because they're concerned about the Zika virus, which is always a concern for young people who want to have children, you know.
And I know that I think it was on your website that I believe it's Pearson's Pond was listed as the world's number four most romantic destination. That's quite the headline there.
Yeah, well, we work hard for our guests, any of our guests, to have the kind of experience that they want. That's what we're all about. So for romantic travelers, honeymooners, we go the extra mile with, you know, rose petals, special treatments, and just try to make it a very unique and happy experience for them. We have a lot of amenities that people like, hot tubs and that sort of thing, that just makes it a much nicer, almost a destination in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Pearson's Pond, you can go to Pearson's Pond and hang out for a week and have a great time.
Anything else about Alaska wedding adventures, either those that you provide or just that the industry here in Juneau is providing that you want people to know about just for future reference?
Well, Juneau is a beautiful spot to get married. There are just so many unique places to do it, so much that you would never get anywhere else, so much in the background, and it's so unique because not everybody does it. So it's really a wonderful place to come if you want to get married and work with anyone. Everybody that works here does a good job of it. So we're always happy to talk to anybody, and we've worked between each other when the time has been right as well. So.
And if people want to find out more, I assume they can just Google Pearson's Pond, Juneau, and they'll probably find your website.
They surely can.
Very good. Well, Mary Ann Ray, a pleasure meeting you, and congratulations with your wonderful work here. And you know, obviously weddings are supposed to be fun, and if having fun and adventure is a good combination here in Juneau, that's a good thing. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, if I could just say one thing. We are, Mark Kelly, the photographer, is working with Nick Jans on a book about Mendenhall Glacier. And he'll be doing a lot of photography up there. We are actually looking for a couple that wants to get married on the glacier so that Mark can come along and maybe take some pictures to feature in the book. So if anybody knows of anyone who's looking for a glacier wedding, please have them call, because we would love to be able to help Mark out.
Adventure plus celebrity. Sounds like a good hook. Thanks for mentioning that.
You're welcome.
Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This magic moment. Different and so new, as like any other, until I kissed you, and then it happened. It took me by surprise. I knew that you felt it too, by the look in your eyes, sweeter than a wine.
Sweeter than wine.
Softer than a song.
Softer.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio our next two guests. We have Allison Gillum, Executive Director with the Southeast Alaska Land Trust, and Kelly Manning, who is the Director at the Canvas. I'm guessing you've got other hats in town, too, perhaps, or is this your primary hat?
This is my primary hat.
Primary hat.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're here today because the Sea Alaska, Southeast Alaska Land Trust has an upcoming event. And it's a workshop. It's a plein air workshop. So, Allison, why don't we just start with you describing a little bit about this event that's coming up?
Yeah, thanks. We partnered with the Canvas on this event last year, and it was really successful. And basically, it's a watercolor workshop with one of their artists, which I can let Kelly talk a little bit about. But basically, yeah, it's a watercolor workshop held out at the Jensen Olsen Arboretum, and that's a special site for the Land Trust because it's the first property we ever protected with a conservation easement back in 1998. So we like to try to have some events that are kind of on properties that we've protected to connect the community with our mission and the lands that we've protected. So the Arboretum is one of those special places for us.
So we'll talk about the workshop in a moment, but maybe just a little bit about the trust for people who are not aware of the work that you folks do.
Right. Yeah. So we're a 501c3 private nonprofit organization, and our mission is land conservation. So basically we partner with municipalities, agencies, and others to protect important natural, recreational, open space, cultural lands, in perpetuity, so forever, and kind of for the benefit of this generation and for the next generation. So that's our basic mission.
And excuse me, how long has the trust been around?
Yeah.
And you mentioned the Arboretum as maybe the first piece of land. So and has there been a lot since?
So we just had our 20th anniversary last year. So 1995 is when we began. So been around for a little while now. And yes, the Arboretum was the first property we've protected. We've now protected 30 properties throughout the region, here in Juneau, Haines, Sitka, Excursion Inlet, Farragut, Bay, and Cake is another area that we've protected properties. We've protected about 3,500 acres now throughout all of Southeast. That's our region.
So you mentioned that this is is this an annual event now? The second annual plein air? Is it a second? So, Kelly, plein air, what does that mean? I realize watercolor is involved, but you hear that phrase, and I'm not sure everybody understands what that is.
Right, yeah. This is the second time that we've done this workshop, and we were actually just discussing that, you know, it's been a great partnership, so it's something we'd like to continue doing. And so plein air is an opportunity to paint in nature, and the idea is it doesn't have to be watercolor. It can be other mediums. For this particular workshop, we're focusing on watercolor as the medium. But it's really being in the environment and painting in and of the environment, and so that's really the intention. And what a beautiful and inspiring space to do that in. The Jensen Olsen Arboretum is just so gorgeous and so many beautiful elements there to work from. So it's a really good fit for us to partner because it's a great opportunity to take what we do and bring it to what they do. And so it's really a good fit. So we are working this year with a visiting artist, and we did this as well last year with our visiting artists. We have a residency artist contractor position that we have at the Canvas, and so Emma Davidson is our contract teacher this year. She's a visiting artist and her education. She has a degree from the Savannah College of Art and Design, so she's here for the year and has a background that's really relevant for this. So she's going to be out there with the artists and teaching different watercolor techniques, resists using salts, some techniques for removing pigment and building layers in the watercolor, which is a little bit challenging, and good to have someone with some skill to give you some tools and techniques that you can take away from the workshop, as well as just be in and of the space for the day.
So this is Saturday, July 16th, correct?
Right. So not this Saturday, but next Saturday.
Right. And you've got two sessions. So talk a little bit about if people are interested, how do they get involved? Do they have to know what they're doing already and things like that? Do they need to bring supplies or all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, great question. So there's two workshops. There's a morning workshop from 10 a.m. to noon and then an afternoon workshop from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. And it's $40 to register. And to register, there is you can go to the southeastalaskalandtrust.org. That's our website. And there is information right on our website there and a link to register and to pay. And the supplies are being generously provided by the Canvas, and we'll be bringing some coffee and cookies. Heritage Coffee is donating coffee for the event, which is really great. So thank you to them.
And before the microphones were turned on, I asked you, is this a fundraiser? And you said, well, not really. It's more of an outreach event. I mean, I'm assuming the fees are helping just pay for the event primarily, but the idea
right.
here is to partner in the community and to embrace the outdoor. Actually, so that's a question. Are the paintings, rain or shine, are they like outside painting, or is it give people a feel for how the day would unfold?
Yeah, well,
there are tents out there.
So I was going to say, last year there was a little bit of, you know, just not heavy rain. And, yeah, there was tents, and people were able to get up underneath the tents and will be working outside.
Yeah.
So so that worked out no problem last year with, you know, the typical summer drizzle that
mm-hmm.
we get. We're hoping for good weather, but, you know, if it's raining, that works just fine. And to a question you had asked a few minutes earlier, too, it's really open to people of any level. So, you know, if they're experienced and they want to kind of build on it, then that's great. If they're new to watercolor, then the instructor will be able to help them get started and learn the basic technique. So it's really open to any level.
How many people per session?
Yeah, so this year we're limiting it to 12 per session, a little bit smaller than last year to you know, allow more focus on each individual student.
Mm-hmm. So do you see this happening every year? I mean, do you feel like you've discovered something that works and you're going to continue it, or just take it a year at a time?
Yeah, I think we're hoping to keep doing it. You will see every year we kind of analyze how it goes and just determine if it's a good event to keep doing together. But it's been we've enjoyed partnering with the Canvas. So
yeah, we're off to a good start on the partnership. So we'll see how it goes from here.
And Emma's the instructor, is
yeah.
that correct? Okay, so it may be for people who are kind of thinking, okay, 2 hours, maybe give them a feel for exactly what they will be doing during those 2 hours.
Right, so, you know, a typical plein air workshop, you have your materials and they'll all be prepped and ready to go. So people will have, you know, an opportunity to kind of choose the area that they're going to work from for their inspiration. And she'll help with, you know, helping people to kind of frame that, because that can be kind of challenging with plein air painting, actually. That's one of the hardest things, is figuring out how to kind of frame your subject when it's not already framed in for you. And so helping with that, helping people to make those decisions. And then the techniques for beginning and applying the watercolors. So it'll kind of depend on what people want to do, but one of her goals is to really kind of teach people resists, which are things to help you kind of create the lines and the frames for your line work. And, you know, if you're doing flowers and things like that, those are really great techniques. And using salts and other techniques to sort of manipulate the watercolor. So in that two-hour time period, you know, it won't get a particularly large piece, but you should be able to get a completed work and then have skills and techniques that you can take with you to then recreate that in your own garden at home, or, you know, when you're out on a hike or whatever it is that you're wanting to take that technique to.
And then finally, plein air, is that French? Do you
I
know?
Believe it is. Yeah.
I believe so, yeah.
And do we know, is that just referring to the outdoors? Or
I think it means like open air.
Open air? Very good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, before we wrap it up here, anything else about the event you wanted to make sure that people knew?
Again, just there's two sessions, a morning session, 10 a.m. to noon, an afternoon session from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. You can pre-register at southeastalaskalandtrust.org, and it's $40 per person.
And if people have questions, they can definitely contact us at the Canvas, and we can help fill in any other questions that people might have about the instruction, and then we'll direct them back to that same website for registration.
Well, it sounds like a lovely event. I'm sure the people who show up are going to really have a good time doing this, and it is such a beautiful location for doing this. So Kelly Manning and Allison Gillum, thank you very much, both of you, for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 6th of July, 2016. 1885 on this day, Louis Pasteur successfully tested his vaccine for rabies. 1896, William Sidney Porter, whom we know as O. Henry, fled from Texas to escape charges of embezzlement. He had worked at a bank. His father-in-law posted bail for him, but Porter fled first to New Orleans and then to Honduras, lay low for a while, and then he got word that his wife was dying of tuberculosis, and he returned to Texas, turned himself in. He served 3 years of a 5-year sentence, during which time he wrote and sold adventure stories to support his daughter, Margaret, who had no idea that her dad was in prison. She was just told that he was away on business. Porter was released from prison for good behavior in 1901, moved to New York, continued writing stories, wrote about one per week, and published his first collection, Cabbages and Kings, in 1904. It's the birthday of the author Hilary Mantel, born in Derbyshire, England, 1952. She had already written several novels and a memoir and a collection of stories when she published Wolf Hall in 2009, historical novel about the life of Thomas Cromwell, the advisor to Henry VIII. She won the Booker Prize for that book and then won the prize again for the sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, 3 years later. One of the judges called her the greatest living English prose writer. She's currently at work on the final book in the Cromwell trilogy called The Mirror and the Light. Hilary Mantel, who said the most frequent question writers are asked is, do you write every day or do you just wait for inspiration to strike? I want to say, of course I write every day. What do you think I am, some kind of hobbyist? But I understand the question is really about the central mystery. What is inspiration? Eternal vigilance, in my opinion, being on the watch for your material, day or night, asleep or awake. And today is the birthday of the 14th Dalai Lama, born in Tibet in 1935 to a farm family. His mother gave birth to him on a straw mat in a cow shed behind the family hut. When he was 2 years old, a search team decided that he was the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama. When he was 23, he fled Tibet to escape the Chinese army, which had brought the country back under Chinese rule. Fled on foot to India, where he's lived ever since as a refugee in Dharamsala. Here's a poem for today by Charles Kingsley, Young and Old. When all the world is young, lad, and all the trees are green, and every goose a swan, lad, and every lass a queen, then hay for boot and horse, lad, and round the world away, young blood must have its course, lad, and every dog his day. When all the world is old, lad, and all the trees are brown, and all the sport is stale, lad, and all the wheels run down, creep home and take your place there, the spent and maimed among. God grant you find one face there you loved when all was young. Young and Old by Charles Kingsley. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Perceptions of President Obama vary a lot. I'm proud of his strength, what he's been able to convey to a nation in the face of adversity.
We have concerns with the way that the president is dividing the country.
I'm Steve Inskeep. We ask Americans how this country has changed in Obama's years. It's an NPR special report.
Thursday evening at 7 on KTOO News.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio Ed Foster. He is the transit superintendent with Capital Transit, our wonderful bus system here in the capital city. And welcome to the studios.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, and it's kind of an exciting thing that you're going to talk about, or at least I think it's exciting. Anything to do with modernizing and new technology that can help improve service, obviously, for people. And there's a new technology involved with the bus system now. And I don't know if Google Trip Planner is the right title for this, but why don't you take it away? Tell people about this new innovation of Capital Transit.
That's basically the title we've been using. And it's more commonly known in the lower 48, where larger cities have been using it for a while. It's basically you can get on Google Maps, and I think everybody's probably used Google Maps at one time or another. And you just click on directions and enter your location and where you want to go, and it will now bring up what Capital Transit bus route you need to take to get there. It'll show you the little line on the map like it always has, but over on the left you'll see another column that has it lists the bus routes that will get you from point A to point B. So you'll know what route of Capital Transit bus system you need to get on to get there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few quirks in it still we're trying to work out. Google likes to work with specific addresses. So if you put in there that you're at Mendenhall Mall,
right,
it won't know. It may tell you you need to walk 2 minutes east or west or something to get to the bus stop because it don't know where you're at. Little idiosyncrasies like that, we can work some of them out with Google by trying to get those addresses so they're not so specific. But it'll work better for you if you know the specific address of where you're going and where you're currently at. But if you just put Mendenhall Mall or and you want to go to Douglas.
Yeah, the valley.
Yeah, it may tell you to, if you're going to Douglas, it may tell you to get off at Crow Hill and walk for 6 minutes to get to Douglas. When if you just stayed on the bus, you would have went to Douglas anyway.
Right.
Little things like that. If you know what the address is you're going to, you're going to get a lot better result.
So an innovation like this, obviously, well, I assume the reason for doing this is because it's going to improve the level of service for bus riders. Their ability to easily, figure out where they're going and how they're going to get there should improve.
Yes.
Correct? Yeah.
Especially the customers that aren't as familiar with the system.
Mm-hmm.
The visitors to town or the people that only ride it occasionally say, oh, I'm going to take the bus today. They don't have to know the schedule. They can just get on Google Map, type in where they're going, and it'll tell them what bus route to get on.
So this is a very nice enhancement to the service. So I'm curious, how long of a project has this been? I mean, is this something that years ago you started working on, or is this relatively new?
Oh, I suppose we've probably been working on it 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
pretty quick. Sounds to me like that's pretty quick for getting it up and running. How did you go about getting it implemented?
Well, we hired a consultant to do all the technical work for us, and we've been working with the consultant to help them understand exactly what our routes are, where all of our bus stops are, how the system works. This is just one step in what they're doing for us. They're also creating a new passenger guide for us, which it'll break the bus routes down more than the schedules that we currently have, which we hope will help people understand better what bus they need to get on to go where they want to go. And they're working on new branding for us. We're doing new branding for transit. We got a new logo that's going to be coming out. The buses are going to look different. They're going to be painted a little different. Trying to revitalize Capital Transit. Mm-hmm. I mean, the buses have looked the same for 20 or 30 years. And we're just trying to bring new life to the system and hopefully attract more people wanting to ride the system.
Is ridership about the same as it's always been? Is it up? Is it down?
It's about the same as it's always been. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, we haven't noticed a large increase, and it hasn't really fallen off a lot. So it kind of stays stagnant. We'd like to see that increase mm-hmm. more.
Do you think this new technology might help that, might facilitate increased ridership?
We hope so.
You'll find out.
I think it almost has to. There are some things, there's some other changes we're going to be making this fall. We've got a couple deadhead runs with we call it deadhead runs when the bus goes from one end of town to the other with nobody in it.
Right.
And we're going to make some changes this fall, probably in October, that are going to start those a little bit earlier so that we can fill them with people before they go to the other end of town.
Mm-hmm.
And those are going to be early morning commuters from Valley downtown and UAS Express from downtown out to UAS. And that you'll hear more about that. That change is coming probably in October.
And I'm assuming that people who ride the bus, they pretty much know what they're doing, or they have a good idea what they're doing.
Most of them do, yes.
Most of them do. But for many people, obviously, in this town, or have their own car, or they're not on the bus system. Is there a single thing or a couple of things that you'd really hope that people who are not riding the bus understand and appreciate about the bus system? You know, I mean, are there things that you'd want to make sure that they're aware of in terms of like the value to the community or what have you?
Well, there's probably a lot. I wish I would have anticipated that one. Made you a list.
But just one or two, you know.
Well,
I have a car, and I take the bus system for granted. I don't ride it, but I just assume it's always going to be there. But yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's naive of me to think it's always going to be there or at an appropriate level for the community and things like that.
I guess one of the things that everybody needs to keep in mind that every one of these buses are on a schedule. It's imperative that they leave when they're supposed to leave and get to where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there, because a lot of people are counting on that to happen. So if they have to sit and wait too long for somebody running down the street trying to catch it or something, it's going to put them behind, mm-hmm. you know. And the traffic construction on Egan this summer has really made that challenging.
Mayhem.
And I guess, I mean, I don't envy DOT's their work out there at all, because it's got to be really difficult to get all that work done with that traffic. But it has been challenging for us to stay on time, on schedule. And another thing is the drivers don't have change. They can't make change when you get on the bus. If you have the correct change, if you don't have a pass, and you got to have the correct change.
Mm-hmm.
Because they cannot make change.
Right. So we got just a couple minutes here. I want to get kind of back to the main reason why you can. I want to make sure if there's anything else about this brand, this new innovation that you really wanted to talk about or make sure the community knew about, I want to make sure you've got opportunity to do that.
Well, another thing we're in the process of doing, we're testing a GPS locator system. And we hope to have the bus locations live online someday.
Mm-hmm.
But as you may know, GPS systems in Juneau are sketchy. You get behind a mountain, they can't see a satellite, you know. So we're testing it. We've got a few on buses right now running around town, and we're monitoring how well they work. And we hope to have that online someday where people can actually see what the location of the buses are
mm-hmm.
live. And we're going to be implementing a new website for Capital Transit in the very near future, probably before November, December.
Very
and
good.
And that's going to be junocapitaltransit.org. It's not active yet, but we hope to have it active by the end of the year.
And then that gets just last question. Challenges right now for the this part of the CBJ budget? I mean, maybe it's an unfair question, but are you guys stable funding? I mean, it sounds like you're able to advance here on some initiatives. That's a good sign.
Funding's always an issue. I mean, like I say, when we come out with this new logo and new branding, we're obviously not going to be able to run out and repaint all of our buses.
Right.
Which we would love to, but the funding's just not there to do that. We have four new buses coming in this fall, and those four buses will be painted with the new design. The new branding, new logos will be on them, so people will be able to see what our objective is. Excuse me.
It's all right. No worries. And actually, we're good because we're coming right up to the end here. So I'll let you try to catch your breath there. So we've been listening to Ed Foster. He's the superintendent with Capital Transit System here in Alaska's capital city. Those buses that provide such a valuable service to the community. So thank you for your work there. And it's very exciting, the Google Trip Planner innovation. And again, if people just go to the CBJ website and go to Capital Transit, they can learn more about this. They can see it right there, right?
Juno.org/Capital Transit. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
She got some water.
That's all right. So, but if people just go to the CBJ website, go to Capital Transit, this is going to pop up, and you're going to be able to learn more about it just on the website itself,
yes.
Correct?
Yep.
Very good. Well, we won't make you struggle anymore on the microphone. So, Ed Foster, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is Bird Note. In the blink of an eye, a bird of prey plummets to the ground, pinning an unwary mouse. A moment later, it flies off, clasping its prey in its feet. A familiar drama we expect of a hawk or falcon, or after dark, an owl. But this bird of prey is a songbird, a bit smaller even than a robin. It's a loggerhead shrike. Silver-gray with black wings and a vivid black mask across the eyes, shrikes look like bandits. This impression's reinforced by the shrike's large head and hooked bill. Male shrikes are well known for impaling their prey on thorns, creating a larder that may help impress potential mates with their hunting prowess. Loggerhead shrikes are found across much of the United States in open country, like pasture and sagebrush. But pesticides and the loss of habitat to residential and commercial uses have reduced shrike populations. Conservation efforts are underway, such as allowing brush to grow along fence lines and leaving small trees and shrubs on the roadside. Reducing or eliminating the use of pesticides can also help sustain this tough customer among the songbirds. To learn more, come to our website, birdnote.org.
It's a tough time to be employed in Alaska's oil and gas industry.
We basically have to tell people that, you know, their contract has expired and there's really nothing for them to work on.
This week on APRN, some oil workers who are holding on to their jobs and some who aren't.
So I'm going to have to make some changes in my personal life. I'm going to do everything possible to keep my home.
Listen for the series An Uncertain Future from Alaska's Energy Desk.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall. Seasonal changes may cause muscle strains and sprains. Ron's Apothecary carries a selection of resources for recovery. First aid kits, healing ointments, braces, and more. Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio Becca Souza. Is that correct?
Yep.
So is that, and who is the STEM program manager and on staff at JEDC? So Juneau Economic Development Council, correct?
Yep.
So the STEM program, let's start right there. You've got these summer camps coming up, and we're going to talk about that. That's really why you're here. But STEM, people hear STEM, and I want to make sure people know what that is.
Yeah, and it's become a buzzword. When we came on this show starting 9 years ago, we always had to correct folks from it's not stem cell research, it's science, technology, engineering, and math. But what's awesome is that word has really gotten out there, and now it's a buzzword in education. People seem to understand what it is, and they're getting more and more of that connection to economic development, how important stressing STEM education is to developing a strong economy and having a vibrant community with potential to grow.
So JEDC has been involved with this program here for how many years?
For 9 years.
For 9 years here in Juneau now. But it's also, that's a very local thing and a state thing, but it's national as well, right?
The movement is, I would even say, international.
Mm-hmm.
And the program that JEDC is involved in, we actually started off with federal funding, which was a national push to say we need to share this knowledge of our scientists and engineers that are moving out of the workforce. The baby boomers are retiring. We need to make sure that we're preparing workforce to fill that gap and to compensate for the, you know, rapid increase in jobs in the tech industry that no one is trained for. And we don't really know what the workforce could look like 10, 20 years down the line because things are changing so quickly.
And so JEDC's connection here perhaps is obvious, that there's a vested interest in making sure that, you know, young students are learning in these fields of expertise and what have you, correct?
Yeah, they're learning and they're thinking. They're not just getting that base science technology, but they're getting all of the project-based entrepreneurship innovation that comes along with a STEM education, not just those siloed subjects.
So you offer these camps. So let's talk about the camps, because the camps are focusing. You've created these fun camps, but the at the foundation is STEM.
Yeah, don't tell anyone, though, because really they're just fun summer camps.
Yeah, so tell us about what's coming up.
And what's left for the summer is a long series of robotics camps. We coordinate the first robotics program for the state of Alaska. So the joy of working with kids all over the state and getting them building and programming Lego robots and then machining their own parts when they get to high school. And this is like a training camp to be involved in that league, or if you're not involved in the league and you just want to learn those individual skills, it's a great chance to get an introduction to computer programming and the engineering design process.
So the remaining class or camp that's available is the robotics?
Mostly. So we've got, I think it's 4 weeks left of robotics, and that's for ages grades 4 through 8. There's a really wide age range that can come and participate. A lot of it is self-driven, so everybody's working at their own pace, and you can get away with some things that it's hard to get away with in the classroom. And then we do have 1 week of Sea Perch Camp. So in addition to our standard robotics camps, we try to pick a couple things that really hit on more local industries. We did rocketry, but, you know, the idea that understanding flight, there's Alaska Airlines is one of our big sponsors for the summer and year-round. So learning some of those concepts, that goes back into the rocketry camp. Sea Perch is our camp in August where you learn underwater robotics, you learn a lot of buoyancy concepts, and everybody leaves camp with a little PVC ROV that you can drop into the water off the dock, check out the bottom of your boat, look at fish, check out seaweed. They're really fun tools and something that actually came out of Navy research and is really applicable to Southeast careers.
So I want to make sure you've got time to talk some details about how to get involved if people are interested. But again, for parents, so the kids are going to have a blast. But again, at the core, the instructors are – this is about STEM. So who are the instructors? How do they get to be a part of this? And I just want parents to realize that this really is based in, you know, some serious learning. But they're going to have fun.
They're going to have a lot of fun. And our instructors are awesome. For Sea Perch, we have Eric Bookless. He's a JDHS graduate who just this year graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks with an engineering degree, and has come back to share his engineering knowledge. He worked with the STEM program back when he was in high school and has come back on and off from the summers, but he's just one of those gifted students who's also great at getting other kids excited about what they're doing. And
really fun at taking on his own projects and her own spin on what could just be, here's how you put together PVC. They're going to be able to get some creative juices flowing. It's just, to me, that's Eric's specialty, is giving them some room to be creative.
And then what is the camp itself? I mean, just so, again, for parents who are thinking, oh, maybe my kid will do this. I mean, what is it that they end up doing? Where do they go? How long is it? Those kinds of things.
Those details. So all of our camps are at Thunder Mountain High School. The robotics camp is in the computer lab over to the left, and the Sea Perch camp is in the shop room in the back for Sea Perch. They're going to be coming in using hand tools, really getting that. If they're kinesthetic learners and like to put things together, that's the camp for them. And in robotics, every kid gets their own robot, their own computer, and they're working on those computer programming skills. Sign-up is all online. It's, if you go to jedc.org, there's a clear link for our summer programs on the front page. You can pay with a credit card or a check, but all the information is right there. And if you don't have access to a computer, don't worry. Just give us a call. My number is 523-2334, and we can register you over the phone and make sure that we have all the information we need.
How long are the camps?
Our robotics camps run 4 days. They're Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and the Sea Perch camp is 5 days, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and that last day is just a big celebration. We get to go over to the Diamond Aquatic Center and actually test out the Sea Perch in the pool. It's a fun collaboration with the pool to get kids in there testing.
And when are the camps, the dates for them?
So they're right this week is our Girls Rock Robotics Camp, and then the following 3 weeks, 4 weeks, there's Monday through Thursday, so the 11th to the 14th, 18th to 21st, 25th through 28th, and August 1st through 4th are all different robotics camp options. You can sign up for one. You can sign up for all four. There's enough variation and opportunities to learn new skills that somebody could go to all four if that's their thing. And then our Sea Perch camp runs July 25th through 29th.
We've got to wrap it up. Anything else, though, not so much about the details about the camps, anything else just about the program that you really want to make sure people understand?
I do. You know, we talked a little bit about funding before we came in, and I just want to say we've got some great summer camp sponsors this year. It's the Juneau Central Labor Council, Alaska Airlines, and AELMP help us to keep the cost reasonable. We still rely on student fees, but they help us subsidize those camps and keep them somewhat reasonable. And then also to Clinkett and Haida, and to the Girl Scouts for partnering and being able to offer some scholarships to their members.
Becca Sosa, STEM Program Manager and on the JEDC staff, thank you very much for coming in, and thanks for making this happen for the kids, for students.
Thanks. Can't wait to see some more kids out next week.
Nice to see you.